From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the search for biological sources of mood disorders and schizophrenia, and for drugs to treat them. We talk with Anne Harrington about her new book, Mind Fixers, which tells the history of psychopharmaceuticals, including Prozac, Xanax, the new antipsychotics, and earlier drugs like lithium, the first drug to treat manic depression.
Unlike all the other drugs, it wasn't invented in a laboratory. It's an element. It's found in the natural world.
But it has side effects. Harrington will also tell us why pharmaceutical companies appear to be leaving the psychiatric field. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Janny Scott's memoir, The Beneficiary, about growing up in a wealthy mainline family in Philadelphia. And linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about the word socialism and its place in current political discourse. The search for a biological understanding of mental illness, including schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, and panic disorder, is the subject of the new book Mind Fixers by my guest Anne Harrington. She writes about the revolution in medications to treat mental illness and why it's left behind what she describes as an unsatisfactory legacy of overdiagnosis, overmedication, and promises that were unfulfilled. Harrington is a professor of the history of science at Harvard and director of undergraduate studies in the history of science. She specializes in the history of psychiatry, neuroscience, and other mind and behavioral sciences. For 6 years, she directed Harvard's Mind, Brain, and Behavior Initiative. Anne Harrington, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's talk a little bit about depression and antidepressants.
Okay.
I think the real game changer here was probably Prozac in the 1980s that became a hugely popular drug. And what was groundbreaking at the time when Prozac came onto the market?
So the irony of Prozac's blockbuster success was that its manufacturer, Eli Lilly, didn't really expect much from it. So Prozac goes on the market. And because it's been framed as safer, people start prescribing it. General practitioners and psychiatrists start prescribing Prozac over other brands, and they also start prescribing it to patients to whom they might previously have hesitated to prescribe what would be perceived as a more dangerous tricyclic antidepressant. So the market for this antidepressant grows in part because the patient pool to whom it's being prescribed grows enormously. And an important subset of that patient pool are patients who previously might have been given a prescription for Valium.
So why does the patient pool grow?
Well, because there had been an enormous market for anti-anxiety medications. And Valium in the 1970s was at that point, in like 1978, I think there was something like 2.2 billion pills of Valium were sold in 1 year. It was the best-selling prescription drug of all time in the 1970s. And it was an anti-anxiety medication, but then it turned out it was addictive. People couldn't get off it. The market for the benzodiazepine plummets. But where are these people? What are we going to do for these kinds of patients? Well, it had long been known that one of the symptoms of depression, it's often anxiety, and so it became possible to think, well, maybe these patients who were previously being diagnosed with anxiety in fact suffer from depression with acute anxiety presentation, and maybe the antidepressants will help, and they did. And so you've got, you know, the expanding pool of people suffering from depression. You've got the emergence of depression in the way we think about it now as the common cold of psychiatry. You've also got a development in which there's a collapse of a previous distinction that the field had made between forms of depression that should be treated medically and forms of depression that were seen to be neurotic or reactive, that were caused by bad stuff going on in your life, and that it was widely thought should therefore be treated with talk therapy. But if medication helps everybody, then maybe these distinctions, some say, aren't so important. Maybe what's more important is the severity of the symptoms. And at some point, the symptoms are severe enough, medication might then be what you choose to prescribe a patient.
So you've got a lot going on there. You've got this new drug Prozac that's supposed to, you know, address depression. You've got patients with anxiety who are being recategorized as having depression with anxiety as a kind of side effect of the depression. They're getting prescribed Prozac too. And at the same time, you have new literature coming out, like Listening to Prozac, the best-selling book by Peter Kramer, that asks the question, you know, like if Prozac is so effective and it's basically remaking people's mood and mental health and changing them, like what does that mean if people can be changed by pills, even if it's changed for the better? Like existentially, what does that mean? But in the long run, how effective was Prozac or is Prozac?
The huge developments that happen in the story of depression and the antidepressants happens in the late 90s, when a range of different studies increasingly seem to suggest that these antidepressants, although they're helping a lot of people, they seem to be helping a lot of people, when compared to placebo versions of themselves, don't seem to do much better. And that is not because they're not helping people, because the placebos are also helping people. That simply thinking you're taking Prozac, I guess, can have a powerful effect on your state of depression. In order, though, for a drug to get on the market, it's got to beat placebo. If it can't beat placebo, the drug fails. And so I think the whole SSRI story, because, of course, there wasn't then just Prozac. There was then Paxil and there was Zoloft. There became a whole family of these drugs. They're all now off patent. And I think that the world of antidepressants is also looking for some new novel chapter. I think it's also hit a kind of standstill.
Do you think those drugs are getting prescribed as frequently or perhaps more frequently than they were in the 80s when Prozac was new and was seen as, you know, this like groundbreaking drug?
There was a glamour moment. We became a Prozac nation. Peter Kramer contributed to the, I think, unintentionally, because his goal was actually to be rather critical rather than celebratory of what he said were Prozac's effects. But he implied that Prozac was a drug that not only normalized but enhanced, and that therefore we would be seeing people taking these drugs not because they necessarily had a diagnosable disorder, but because it would give them an edge or lift their mood or help them become the kind of person they would prefer to be. And he said, you know, we're worried about this, maybe we don't like it, but let's not be naive. This is what's going to happen and we need to grapple with it. That was his argument, but it was taken to be a kind of endorsement of a kind of legal street drug culture in which people are on Prozac for trivial reasons or for hedonistic reasons or for professional advancement reasons. I think we're past that moment. I think people still go on SSRIs. I think there's a more sober, in general, sort of set of calculations that are undertaken. I think people are more aware of side effects and the difficulties of getting off long-term use.
In writing about the biology of mental illness and the drugs that have been created to address it, you write some about the marketing of those drugs. And let's look at one of the really successful marketing campaigns, and that would be for Xanax, which was approved by the FDA in 1981. And that coincided with the end of the diagnosis of anxiety neurosis and the addition in the DSM of the diagnosis of panic disorder. So How is Xanax marketed to tie in to this new diagnosis of panic disorder?
So Xanax was originally going to be the next generation to Valium. It's being tested and developed several decades before it finally gets FDA approval. In the interim, the market for drugs, benzodiazepines like Valium, largely collapses. In the interim, the disorder for which patients were being prescribed Valium, you know, neurotic anxiety, is deemed to no longer be a valid diagnostic category. The DSM comes out. And so now you've got a drug, maybe as good as Valium, maybe better than Valium, but whatever it is, it's a benzodiazepine, and it doesn't have the diagnostic category for which it was originally developed doesn't exist anymore. But in the DSM, there are other new forms of anxiety that are meant to be more targeted, that are meant to slice and dice more precisely the spectrum of anxiety, forms of anxious suffering that people suffer from. And one of these is a disorder that most people had never heard of called panic disorder. And there had been previous arguments and research suggesting that panic disorder has a biological substratum, that it's a genuine medical condition distinct from the forms of anxiety that the psychoanalysts used to see or that the GPs used to give patients Valium for. Originally, it was felt, therefore, that the benzodiazepines weren't effective on panic disorder, that you should give them antidepressants. But the makers of Xanax needed to sell Xanax, and they therefore took a second look at the possibility that their drug might be effective for panic disorder, not because they didn't think it was going to be more effective than, say, Valium might be, but they needed to sell Xanax. And it is effective, and it gets approved by the FDA as the first targeted medication for a disorder that most people had at that point never heard of, called panic disorder. And part of the marketing of all of these efforts to target often older drugs for new disorders is to educate or tell people about this disorder that they've not potentially ever heard of, persuade them to wonder whether or not they might suffer from them themselves, and persuade them to discuss that possibility with their physician.
So you had mentioned that the market for Valium had collapsed before the release of Xanax. Why was the market for Valium collapsing?
Because the growing recognition that benzodiazepines were highly addictive. There were a number of very high-profile kinds of cases, including Betty Ford, the wife of the president, of people who publicly confessed that they were Valium addicts and needed to go into rehab. It became perceived, whereas once drugs like Valium were seen as kind of no more dangerous than having a pick-me-up cup of coffee in the morning, were seen as dangerous drugs, as addictive drugs.
Is Xanax less addictive than Valium?
Good question. I don't know, because I'm not a clinician, but I can say that you are now beginning to see some of the kinds of conversations about drugs like Xanax that you saw about drugs like Valium 40 years ago or so.
Let's talk about bipolar syndrome, which has its roots as a diagnosis in what was called manic depression. So what is the difference between manic depression and bipolar? Are they the same thing, just renamed, or are they two separate diagnoses?
Some people use the term more or less interchangeably. The term manic depression was widely used until the 1980s to describe a form of mood disorder that classically involved cycling between experiences of great agitation or elevation and moods of great depression. In the 1980s, the term bipolar disorder was swapped out in the DSM-3 for manic depression, and it was swapped out in part because of some genetic research that some felt at the time showed clearly that there were two kinds of mood disorder. There was depression, which some people then suggested could be renamed unipolar disorder. And there was the disorder formerly known as manic depression that could then be known as bipolar disorder. Not everyone agreed then or now with this bifurcation, and there's been a push among some clinicians and experts to reintroduce the more expansive category of manic depression disorder. But I also think there was a feeling among the public. I mean, the number of the advocacy groups changed their name also, and they didn't do it primarily or only because of the genetic work. They did it because they felt that manic depressive disorder frightened people as a term, that bipolar disorder was a more sort of friendlier and less stigmatizing way of talking about this form of suffering.
What was it about the words manic depression That sounded more frightening than bipolar disorder.
Well, I think mania and the maniac and, you know, it invoked a sort of wild-eyed, potentially violent forms of behavior, and that was not at all the kind of message that an advocacy organization would be wanting to convey. They didn't want people who were frightened off from seeking help.
So I think the first drug that was used to treat manic depression was lithium, which you write was previously marketed as a health tonic. That amazed me when I read it.
Really? The first thing to know about lithium, to understand its strange place in the history of psychiatry, is that unlike all the other drugs, it wasn't invented in a laboratory. It's an element. It's found in the natural world, and it's found, for example, in certain kinds of spas in Europe that in the past, you know, bragged about their high lithium content of their drinking water. And so it had a place in spa culture. It had a place as a feel-good tonic. It was, for a period of time, an ingredient in a new lemon-lime soft drink that became quite popular in up through the 1950s, that gets renamed 7-Up.
And 7-Up had lithium in it?
7-Up had lithium in it, and there's no one quite knows for sure why Griggs, the inventor of this soft drink, it had a very convoluted previous name, but it was renamed 7-Up, and some think that this might be a reference to the atomic number of lithium. It's just under 7, and the up meaning the suggestion that it lifts the mood. Lithium is no longer in 7-Up, and cocaine is no longer in Coca-Cola.
Right.
But there was this previous history of lithium. And then lithium sort of fortunes as a product. And it's used in all sorts of other things, too, that have nothing to do with, the health industry. But its fortunes as a product in the health industry take a nosedive when it is used as the basis, or a compound of lithium is used as the basis for a salt substitute that ends up, people believe, causing heart problems and even several deaths. And so there's a warning sent out by the AMA and then eventually FDA that, you know, these salt substitutes, take them off the market. This is a dangerous drug. And so lithium's emergence in psychiatry emerges against the background of two relevant facts. One, it has a reputation now for being dangerous. And two, it's not going to make a pharmaceutical company very much money because they can't patent it.
So is lithium still like a drug of choice for treating patients with bipolar disorder?
I think there are a lot of people who say it's a very good drug. And there are some people to still take lithium. The problem with lithium, and I use the word problem, you know, it's not a problem for patients as much as it's a problem for the industry and the way in which the industry is a player in these, how things develop, is that it wasn't profitable. Certain clinicians had to basically go and petition several pharmaceutical companies to even market it after it received FDA approval in the 1970s. No one was interested in it. So what then happened is the drug companies found ways to make treatment for bipolar disorder more profitable by developing other patentable or proprietary drugs. And the first generation of these were drugs that had formerly been anti-epileptic drugs, names like Tepicote, that they then called mood stabilizers. And now a lot of people are on the second generation or atypical antipsychotics that also in the 90s and beyond got FDA approval as treatments for bipolar disorder.
So lithium was taken off the market as a salt substitute because of its side effects. But then, you know, lithium as a drug to treat manic depression or bipolar disorder, is it still seen as having the harmful side effects, possibly cardiac side effects?
Well, I think what does happen is that people incorporate a recognition that there is this risk, and there's then people on lithium undergo regular blood monitoring. and then adjustment of their dose to reduce the risk of a cardiac incident.
My guest is Anne Harrington, author of the new book Mind Fixers, Psychiatry's Troubled Search for the Biology of Mental Illness. We'll talk more after a break. We'll also hear Maureen Corrigan's review of Janie Scott's memoir about growing up in a wealthy mainline family in Philadelphia. Her grandmother was said to be the inspiration for Katharine Hepburn's character in the film The Philadelphia Story. And linguist Jeff Nunberg will talk about a word we're hearing a lot now, socialism. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Nature's Way, maker of herbal supplements from ashwagandha to turmeric. Nature's Way believes nature knows best. This is why, since 1969, they have sought out the best herbs the earth has to give, and why they travel the world to the places where herbs grow best to ensure they always deliver the purest botanicals possible. Find out more today at naturesway.com.
Let's get back to our interview about the search for a biological understanding of mental illness and for drugs to treat it. My guest is Harvard professor Anne Harrington, author of the book Mind Fixers. So your book is about basically like the history of pharmaceutical treatment for mental health disorders. And at the end of the book, you say that you think a lot of pharmaceutical companies have been leaving the psychiatric field, and I was very surprised to read that because it seems like just about everybody is on something right now. And why would pharmaceutical companies be leaving when so many people are on antidepressants or treatment for bipolar disorder, you know, not to mention antipsychotics? And it's hard to get off of many of these drugs. So once you're on it, like, you tend to stay on them. So why would pharmaceutical companies be leaving?
Because there's been no new good ideas as to where to look for new novel biomarkers or targets since the 1960s. The only possible exception is there's now some excitement about ketamine, which targets a different set of biochemical systems. But R&D is very expensive. These drugs are now mostly off patent. Their efforts even to develop, you know, for decades, they've been tinkering around the edges of the same kinds of molecular targets. And even their efforts to bring on new drugs in that sort of tried and true and tested way, with a tinker here and a tinker there, has been running up against mostly unexplained but indubitable problems with the placebo effect.
The drugs don't seem to get better results than people getting a placebo.
That's right, but it doesn't mean that the drugs don't work. It just means that the placebo effect is really strong. Mm-hmm. But the logic of clinical trials is that the placebo effect is nothing, and you have to be able to be better than nothing. But of course, if the placebo effect isn't just nothing, then maybe you need to rethink what it means to test a drug. Now, this sort of goes beyond what historians should be talking about, but it does seem that the pharmaceutical company has a big placebo problem on its hands.
You know, in talking about a new drug has to beat the placebo in test trials in order to be approved by the FDA.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear more research about the placebo effect. It obviously exists. We should find a way of harnessing it better.
Well, I agree with that. Before I wrote Mind Fixers, I spent quite a bit of time being interested in the placebo effect as a really interesting and understudied and under-theorized entity in its own right. And I followed the research of people who are trying to show this. Look, there's a biology of the placebo effect, and if you give people fake morphine, you know, you can see changes in their brain. If you give people fake antidepressants, you can see changes in their brain. So there's a real biology here. And yet, I think the tempting conclusion that, well, why don't we just give people placebos if they're so good, is a dangerous one.
No, you'd be lying to them. You'd be telling them it's a drug when it's not.
Well, that's some people say, oh, you can get around that by telling people that You know, we found these drugs, you know, this is a drug with no side effects because it's got no active ingredients, and we found it to be very effective. Evidence shows it's effective with people with your condition. But I think that the placebo effect is as powerful as it is because it's parasitic. It's parasitic on the pharmaceutical industry. People don't believe in the placebo effect, and I don't think any amount of reframing is going to profoundly change that. People believe in medicines. And you just have to see why the placebo effect is likely on its own not going to be our solution. You just have to go back to a world before these pharmaceuticals came on the market, before we had drugs, and ask any older psychiatrist who remembers those years what it was like. Now, where I do think that there's a lot of room to pay more attention to the placebo effect going forward is in the ways in which it's present even when you're taking an active drug. There's always a placebo effect. The placebo effect isn't just the effect of a fake drug. It's just that we can see it more clearly there when there aren't other confounding factors. There's always a placebo effect. And the placebo effect also points us to the ways that we're more than just biochemical systems in the narrow reductionistic understanding of the word, that we respond to a relationship with a doctor. We respond to what we're told when we're given a medication. We respond to going to this hospital rather than some other hospital because we read in the U.S. News and whatever report that it's a great hospital, or we read something different about it. It reminds us that a biochemistry is not all there is. It does offer and open up a possibility of, I think, a more interdisciplinary and more holistic way of thinking, even about drug treatment.
So you teach at Harvard, and you've been teaching how many years?
Oh, over 20.
Mm-hmm. So in that time, I doubt you ask students if they're on medication, but maybe there's a way you can kind of get a sense of that. Do you think that the number of students on various mental health and anti-anxiety disorder medications has increased or decreased over time? And do you think attitudes among your students, have changed about those medications?
So I have both been teaching at Harvard for over 20 years, teaching large undergraduate courses, including courses on the history of psychiatry. So I get a lot of students who come with histories, because that's why they're drawn to the course. I also, though, live with undergraduates. I'm what's called a faculty dean of a residential community on the Harvard campus. And so I get to know these students personally. And when they have problems and struggles and anxieties, I'm sort of listening and there. And so, and my impression is that, I think that they're more fragile. They feel more fragile to me. But I also know that when 10 years ago, I wasn't living with them. So I may just be the fact that I now see more up close how fragile they feel, how much they struggle. And I think that a lot of them are on medication. I think that the reasons they're on medication sometimes are probably medical and sometimes are because it will help them, even though they don't necessarily, in my non-clinical view, but just knowing them as people, it's that it will help them get through. And I have come to believe that there are reasons sometimes to go on medication that are not simply because you have a biochemical imbalance or you have some kind of biological defect.
So are you saying that there's times in the lives of the students where they benefit from medication even though they don't have like a diagnosed disorder?
Let me try to say this carefully because it's important. A person can be depressed A person can be hugely anxious. And the reasons that a person is deeply depressed or hugely anxious sometimes is not discernible, and sometimes is discernible. We don't know enough about the biology of these mental disorders to know whether or not, you know, some of the reasons are biological in the sense that medicine likes to think of these things as diseases, and whether it's just because they're, you know, having terrible problems, you know, their family at home is struggling and they having trouble concentrating on their homework and they're not doing well in school and they can't, you know, and they get more and more despairing. Do they have a disease? I don't know. Do they need help? Yes, I think they do. What are the options available to them? Well, I would love to see a larger, more pluralistic set of options, but I do have come to believe that medication sometimes might want to be one of them. But again, it comes back to what we were saying before. There needs to be a honest risk-benefit assessment that includes the person who's going to take the medication. It's so important that, you know, we're involve the patients, the people who are on these drugs in the conversations and talk to them about why this might help, what we do, what we don't know. And move forward in our imperfect world to try to deal with the suffering.
Anne Harrington, I want to thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciated the chance.
Anne Harrington is the author of the new book, Mind Fixers. After we take a short break, Maureen Corrigan will review a new memoir by Jani Scott about growing up in a wealthy Philadelphia family. It's called The Beneficiary, Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Father. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from ExxonMobil, the company that believes that carbon capture technologies are critical for lowering global CO2 emissions. And more scientists agree. As a leader in capturing emissions in its own operations, ExxonMobil is working on ways to make this technology more efficient and affordable for other industries as well. That's the unexpected energy of ExxonMobil. Find out more at energyfactor.com.
Summer movie season is here and Pop Culture Happy Hour has you covered. For a guide through the blockbusters you know about and the surprise bright spots you might not, we'll tell you what we are looking forward to, what we're secretly dreading, and what might sneak up on us. Listen now and subscribe.
Jani Scott is a former New York Times reporter and the author of the 2011 book A Singular Woman, the biography of Ann Dunham, Barack Obama's mother. Now Scott has trained her biographical research skills on her own extraordinary family. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of The Beneficiary.
Many years ago, I worked as an academic day laborer on Philadelphia's Main Line. For those unfamiliar with it, the Main Line developed in the late 19th century along a railroad route west of the city, was for decades a quietly grand stretch of lavish estates, private schools, and cricket and golf clubs catering to Philadelphia's old money. The classic 1940 romantic comedy, The Philadelphia Story, starring Katharine Hepburn as a snooty socialite, was set on the Main Line. Hepburn herself attended Bryn Mawr College, one of the mainline institutions I was adjunct teaching at to cobble together a living. At the end of a workday, I'd ride back to Philadelphia aboard the commuter train, staring through the always grimy windows at all the charming houses and landscape gardens passing by. I envied the folks who lived inside those houses and what I saw as their legacy of ease and beauty. Jani Scott lets me know I was nothing but a stranger in a strange land, incapable of decoding the more intricate stories flickering before my eyes. Scott, who was an award-winning reporter for the New York Times, has written a vivid and penetrating memoir called The Beneficiary about her own illustrious mainline family and the hefty emotional weight of inheritance. To give you a quick sense of her pedigree, Scott's great-great-grandfather was a railroad baron and mentor to Andrew Carnegie. Her daring and glamorous grandmother, Helen Hope Montgomery, was said to be the inspiration for the Hepburn character in the Philadelphia story. Growing up, Scott and her siblings, along with four generations of relatives, lived in houses scattered over an 800-acre mainline estate, which also boasted stables, a dairy farm, swimming pools, and a couple of one-room schoolhouses. Occasionally playing to the base desires of us proletarians, eager to hear absurd things about wasps, Scott recalls the Sunday night suppers presided over by her grandparents at the big house that were required attendance. On the menu, cold roast beef, a hodgepodge Scott's parents called vomit salad, and mint chocolate chip ice cream with a dusting of Nestle's chocolate powder. One unhappy in-law described the ritual as the Sunday night ghastlies. As a young adult, Scott says, the oddness of her upbringing began to come into focus. Early in this memoir, she tells a story about herself as a college student, catching a ride home with a friend whom she describes as a brainy first-generation American. We were approaching my parents' house, Scott recalls, passing a wall of evergreens through which one could catch sight of the fenced fields beyond. "Where are the slave quarters?" my friend asked, teasing, sort of. I knew the place intimately, Scott says. I understood it, not at all. The beneficiary is Scott's clear-eyed attempt to understand that place and the privileged but hermetically sealed life it gave to her family. She sets out to scrutinize the hidden, soul-draining costs of having an entire life, education, career, marriage, prefabricated for you before birth. Above all, though, Scott yearns to understand the beneficiary who's most elusive and compelling to her. That would be her father, Robert Montgomery Scott, a clubby, public-spirited patrician who served as president of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Scott's father nursed a somewhat socially acceptable lifelong addiction to alcohol, as well as a socially unacceptable struggle with depression and a persistent sense of inauthenticity. After his death, Scott unearths the decades' worth of journals her father bequeathed to her. His voice is arresting in its despair. Listen to this entry in which he talks about his marriage. "I am married to a charming, spoiled wife with whom I have little in common but background. My failure at the tennis court eliminated what she felt to be the sphere in which we would have experiences together. And the result is that we have no common experiences except our background. We live our background. Our house is our two generations of money flowing into more of culture. This is no way to live." Scott judiciously quotes from her father's journals, but whenever she does so, it's evident that there have been at least two gifted writers in her family, father and daughter. The Beneficiary is a wise and poignant memoir about all the things money can buy and all the things it can't.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Beneficiary by Jani Scott. After we take a short break, our linguist Jeff Nunberg will talk about the word socialism and its place in current political discourse. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from the all-new 2019 Subaru Forester, with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and award-winning safety technology to give you extra confidence on every drive. Inside, it features a spacious, upgraded interior with heated seats, AC vents, and USB ports, all available for second-row passengers as well as the front. The 2019 Subaru Forester. Welcome to the SUV for all you love. Learn more at Subaru.com.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. There are lots of places to debate today's issues if you don't mind getting attacked for speaking your mind or asking a simple question. But 1A is different. You'll find the 1A podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Since the early 20th century, the word socialism has lived on the fringes of American political discourse. Now suddenly it's at the forefront of the national conversation. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts on the label that came in from the cold.
Time was when the word socialism had a firm footing in the American political lexicon, with all the meanings it has collected in the other nations where it's taken root. It could be mixed or pure, planned or market, a dogma or simply an aspiration, the name of our desire, as the critic Irving Howe famously defined it. But after the American socialist movement crumbled in the 1920s, the right compacted the word into a single term of abuse. It became the S-word, which is the title that John Nichols of The Nation magazine gave to his recent history of socialism in America. From Social Security and unemployment insurance to Medicare and the Affordable Health Care Act, Republicans have labeled every social welfare program proposed by Democrats as socialist, socialistic, or creeping socialism, a phrase coined by Thomas Dewey in 1939. Give socialism a foothold, they'd say, and nothing can arrest the slide to perdition. In 1936, Herbert Hoover said that FDR's socialist policies were leading America on a march to Moscow. With the fall of the Soviet Empire half a century later, Republicans had to redirect that road to a warmer destination. As Vice President Pence told the Conservative Political Action Committee last March, "We know where socialism needs. Just look at Venezuela." But the logic hasn't changed since Hoover's time. Passing universal health care or a $15 minimum wage is like picking up a Monopoly card that says, "Go directly to Caracas, do not pass Stockholm." Until recently, Democrats dismissed those charges as fear-mongering. In 1952, Harry Truman called socialism a scare word and said that when a Republican says down with socialism, he really means down with progress. But the S-word isn't quite as spine-chilling now, particularly to millennials. They have no memory of the Cold War. They can't tell you what the second S in USSR was for. And the fall of the Berlin Wall is just one of a mash of 80s film clips along with the Exxon Valdez, Pac-Man, and Boy George. The upheaval that shaped their political perceptions was the financial meltdown of the mid-2000s. That made them keenly aware of the mayhem that Godzilla capitalism could wreak, and of the economic inequality that the Occupy movement captured with quantitative precision with the new phrase, the 1%. Socialism began to sound like a needed corrective, particularly once it was personified by a cantankerous old senator from Vermont and a young congresswoman from New York with a digital native's talent for social media. Both of them avowed socialists, as the media sometimes describe them, in the way they've traditionally referred to avowed atheists and avowed homosexuals. By 2018, a majority of millennials said they had a positive view of socialism, including quite a few Republicans. Not all of those who look kindly on socialism go on to label themselves as socialist or democratic socialists. To many of them, the word evokes phrases like the social contract, another term that's been in the air a lot lately. But however they describe themselves, the great majority of millennials associate socialism with New Deal-style programs like universal health care and access to free higher education, not state control of business. And while they give low marks to capitalism, they aren't hostile to free markets. In fact, an overwhelming majority say they approve of the free enterprise system. That's not a contradiction. It's the difference between accepting the rules of the game and saying it could be played a little more decently. After all, you can love football but hate the NFL. The fact is that most of the millennial fans of socialism don't see the role of government that differently from the people who still call themselves progressives or liberals, though they tend to be more dogged about it. To conservatives, that just means that millennials don't know the true meaning of the word socialism. Conservatives often seem to assign magical powers to the word. Call yourself a socialist and you summon the specter of Stalin, whether you meant to or not. You think you're calling for guaranteed health care, but you're really calling for gulags and collectivization. Actually, as John Nichols points out, the recent popularity of socialism has a lot to do with the way conservative media slathered the word over Barack Obama and his programs, both of which were fairly popular. That's a risk Republicans run when they frame the Democrats' positions as socialistic. They may inadvertently detoxify the brand, particularly when the connections to Marxism are hard to discern. Senator McConnell recently denounced what he called the Democrats' radical, half-baked socialist proposal to make Election Day a federal holiday. But more than two-thirds of Americans think that's a good idea, and if that makes them socialist, well, what's to be frightened of? A lot of voters are still skittish about socialism, so that all the Democratic hopefuls other than Sanders have had to forswear the label. Though, as the Florida Democrat Andrew Gillum noted, it's not as if that will stop Republicans from calling them socialist anyway. But it's no longer exclusively the Republicans' word to define or demonize. It's a contested label now, just as conservative is on the right. It isn't yet clear where socialist will settle in the vocabulary of the American left as it jostles with labels like liberal and progressive. But it's not the S word anymore. That might be the most consequential change in American political language since the era when Herbert Hoover was walking the earth.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll talk about the Mueller report with Rosalind Helderman, an investigative reporter for the National Political Staff of The Washington Post. She co-wrote the commentary and analysis in the Post's publication of the report. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our engineer today is Adam Stanishevsky. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.